Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mom and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And it's kind of a cloudy day today, but we need the rain, so it's fine with me.
That's true. In fact, I hope it rains a whole lot more.
Yeah, me too.
So, we have a really amazing book today to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, like Mom says, this is the kind of book that you pick it up, you can't put it down, you really want to know what happens.
Right.
Good luck with that, a novel by Kristen Higgins. And Kristen is a best-selling author. She's a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of nearly 20 novels, which have been translated into more than 2 dozen languages and have sold millions of copies worldwide. Her books have received many awards. She's a 6-time nominee for the Kirkus Prize for the Best Work of Fiction. And Kristen lives in Connecticut with her family. And welcome to Writer's Voices, Kristen.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Good luck with that. is a novel, you know, I suppose it would be considered contemporary women's fiction, contemporary romance, but it's more than that, isn't it?
Well, yes, I like to think so. It's what's shelved as, you know, in bookstores, it's called women's fiction. And, you know, there's a romantic element in it, but it's a book about three friends coming to terms with the issues involved in body image and self-esteem. These women, Georgia, Emerson, and Marley, met at weight loss camp as teenagers, and 17 years later, one of them dies from complications related to obesity. And she leaves her surviving friends, Georgia and Marley, this list that they made the last day of camp called Things We'll Do When We're Skinny. And she makes them promise to do the things on the list. And some of the things are kind of silly and adolescent, like, you know, tuck in a shirt because they feel, you know, you have to look a certain way to do that, which, of course, you don't. But it's an indication of confidence levels, you know, that they have been told from, in George's case, a very young age, that they're somehow wrong. Their body shape is not pleasing to the rest of the world. And so to honor Emerson and to kind of kickstart themselves, they decide to tackle the list. And the book is structured around these items, tuck in a shirt or eat dessert in public, which Marley says she's got down pat, and but also some more meaningful things like confront the people who judged us because we were heavy. And by doing the list and kind of mourning their friend, these two women start out on this path to realizing how much body image has shaped their self-esteem, even when they didn't want it to, how much messaging there is out there for women to look a certain way, and how much they value each other and love each other and help each other come to terms with the fact that size doesn't matter, that you need to love and appreciate yourself exactly as you are right now, no putting it off.
Now, Kristen, I've seen a picture of you, and you look pretty amazing.
Thank you.
But you write as if you really understand what it's like to be fat.
Well, I'm one of those women who has always felt too big, you know, and I was told that from an early age on. I have very athletic siblings who never, you know, never were overweight. I was a chubby toddler. That was something that was discussed very in front of me by family members in school, you know, that I was overweight. And I, like so many women, I always thought, like, I've got to lose weight for whatever is next, you know, whether it's starting a new high school at the age of 14, you know, I've got to lose weight so I look like the other girls, or being in a school play where I thought, oh my gosh, all these people are going to look at me, I've got to lose weight for that, going away to college, you know, you just, whatever significant event in my life that was coming, I thought, I've got to lose weight for that. And, you know, I've been heavier than I am and slimmer than I am. I've done a lot of bad eating habits throughout my life, you know, on both ends of the spectrum, from deprivation to, binging. And so I think that, you know, despite your size, we women are victims to these messages of, you know, lose weight, look, get beach ready, you know, get wedding ready, bounce back from your baby, those kind of things. They're everywhere telling us that we're not the right size and we have to work harder. And it's a message that men and boys get, but to a much less degree. So I think that, you know, being uncomfortable in your body is not relegated to people who weigh a certain amount, or, you know, I think it's a universal experience, unfortunately. And if you're one of those women who has never had that, God bless you. I'm so happy for you, and I want us all to get there. So you're great examples. Keep up the good work.
No, you're right. It's I think every woman probably at some point has had felt like their body wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
It starts at a very early age.
It does.
Very early age.
I think I was 4 the first time I realized I was chubby.
Wow.
And I was in this little rinky-dink beauty pageant that my mom entered me into because she thought I was adorable. And
good for her.
I was the first girl kicked off, because that's what you do with 4-year-olds. You tell them, you know, you're not as pretty as the rest. And the judge told me, you're out. You're too chubby.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
I was so, I remember that feeling of shock. Because before that, I had been happy and excited, and I thought it was fun. And then this feeling of shock of, like, oh, my gosh, of all the girls up here, you know, I am the least in some way. And,
that is horrible.
Thank you. It really is. And, you know, this was a long time ago. I'm 53, so this was, you know, in 1969, I guess. But that kind of stuff happens all the time to girls and women. Mm. You know, people feel free to comment on how you look, whether it's, you know, you look great, hey, mama, you know, guys appreciating you in the street, or unwanted attention, sexual harassment. You know, we all know about the Me Too movement and how universal an experience that is. And then also people who, you know, who feel free to judge you and tell you, like, oh, you've gained weight, you don't look so good, or have you tried this diet, you know. And I really wanted to go there in Good Luck With That. I really wanted to dig into how insidious these messages are and how they can eat away at our self-esteem. And each woman has some degree of experience in that. Emerson has it the worst. She is what is medically called super morbidly obese, which means she has a BMI of 50 or more. And in the beginning of the book, in the first chapter, she passes away from these complications. She has been bedbound for 1.5 years, and, you know, there's just no way that she can turn her life around. She's sort of given in to her addiction. And I wanted to write a character of that size because I think that a lot of us look at people who are that size and judge them and say, like, wow, you know, how did it get so out of hand? How did it go so far? It's one thing to be overweight. I mean, 2/3 of us, according to the NIH, are overweight in America. But when we see someone who is immobilized and in agonizing pain because of their weight, you say, why did you do that to yourself? And there's not a lot of compassion for that. There's not a lot of understanding of this is an addiction, just like heroin is an addiction. And just like any addict, Emerson is helpless in the face of her addiction. She's never able to conquer it. And she isolates herself from the people who want the best for her, and has a few toxic people in her life who enable her. And I think that by showing her through her journal entries throughout the book, you start to see her as a character who is intelligent and kind and funny and very shy and a really lovely person, but who's constantly being bombarded with the idea that she's not right and she doesn't have a place in this world. And I wanted to show her and to show the damage that we do, often without thinking, often, you know, because we're well-meaning. But the marks that that leaves.
When I was reading, particularly in the first half of the book, it really made me think about my attitudes towards people who are significantly overweight. And even though I, you know, don't think I've ever made fun of someone or said anything cruel or unkind to someone about their weight, or hopefully about anything really, but I realized that when I meet somebody who's significantly overweight, I'm less likely to think of them as someone I would want to be friends with.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't, that's uncommon, you know. They say that fat is the last acceptable discrimination.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I had never really thought about, I mean, I grew up on the opposite end of the spectrum where I got made fun of for being too skinny a lot, and it damaged my body image too. Well, then later as an adult, I gained weight and I've been skinny, I've been overweight, but not, you know, I've always been within the normal range, I guess. And so I've never had that feeling of, you know, walking into the room, everybody's looking at me, everybody's judging me. And I hadn't really thought about the impact that would have on somebody.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad
in our culture.
Open your eyes then.
Yeah. But Mom?
Well, in our culture, you know, the problem is we don't judge people by what's on the inside, whether they have integrity or not. We judge them on the outside. We do that all the time, whether mm-hmm. tall or short or fat or skinny. You know, it's really sad that we don't try to get to know people so many times. I have some friends who are obese, and I have gotten to know them, and you know they're fine people. And
right. And I think you know we do. You know, we do judge people on how they look. That's our first impression of someone is, you know, for most of us, what we see.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's, you know, it's very common to make judgments on people, whether they're, you know, unclean or you think like, oh, you know, you're not someone who takes care of yourself or you're covered in dog hair, which is always a plus in my eyes. You love dogs. You know, I remember someone saying, you know, how you present yourself to the world is an invitation for how they're going to view you. If you are disabled, if you are morbidly obese, if you are, you know, super thin, you might not have control over how people see you. You know, I have a cousin who uses a wheelchair, and people make assumptions about her all the time because of her disability.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, in the cases of these women in the book, Emerson certainly is judged immediately or found fascinating, you know, by some of the, she calls them the fawns, the delicate fawns that she works with, you know, these slim young women who find her kind of fascinating and not, you know, in a negative way, but just like, wow, you know, and they'd offer her diet tips and stuff like that. And, you know, they like her. They like her as a person, but they're kind of fascinated with her size. And, you know, if you watch some of the shows on television that kind of fetishize with super morbidly obese people like My 600-Pound Life or something. You see how.
So that's a real show?
It is.
Oh, yeah. It is. Yeah.
Why would anybody want to be on that?
Well, they're offered gastric bypass. And it shows their, you know, their shows, but it also makes them seem, it's like infantilizes them in some way. And it makes them seem like you just don't know how much you're supposed to eat. And that's one thing I address in Good Luck with That is, I say, there's a line, no one knows more about nutrition than an overweight American woman. You know, it's not that you're ignorant or unintelligent, it's that food is an addiction. And you're eating to cover a wound or bury a wound, and that's certainly true in Emerson's case. In George's case, you know, she's more of my own experience of yo-yo dieting, of always judging herself more harshly, I think, than the world judges her. But she grows up with this very judgmental mother who's very thin and beautiful and is one of those women who believes her value comes from how she looks. So she doesn't understand this daughter who places value on, you know, your intelligence and kindness and loyalty. Georgia is a Yale graduate. She's a Princeton graduate. She's a lawyer. She's a preschool teacher. She has all these wonderful qualities, but all her mother sees is a fat kid or a fat adult, and it's always about her weight.
Oh, gosh.
And her mother felt judged by the fact that she has an overweight daughter.
Right.
Like it's some reflection on her, which in a way it is, because if she hadn't been so hard on her, she might not have turned to food.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, exactly. I think, you know, so many of us use food as punishment or reward or comfort. I think it's a very natural thing to do. And this book is not about losing weight. Good Luck with That is absolutely against that idea that you need to look a certain way or weigh a certain number, be a certain size in order to start going after what you want and really enjoying life. And I think that the idea of looking in the mirror and appreciating what's there and taking care of yourself the way you would take care of your friend, your best friend, is such an important message. You know, I think as women, we place a great value on friendship. And Marley and Georgia are so close, and they're so good to each other. They're the kind of friend that everyone deserves. And how they are with each other is how they have to learn to be to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to be kind and loving and caring to themselves as they are to their friends and family members. One of the storylines that's my favorite in the book is George's relationship with her nephew, Mason, who's 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And he also has body image problems. He's little, he's skinny. His father is a super athlete, marathoner, and very judgmental about his son not being tall enough, not being fast enough, not being athletic enough. And I think that, you know, the way Georgia is with Mason is the way she needs to be with herself.
Agreed.
You know,
agreed.
You know, another thing that people don't realize, I think, is that some people can eat anything because their metabolism is such that they don't gain weight. And other people can eat very little and still gain weight.
Right.
And
right.
It's we're all different. It's like
can
we all
vary
react
at the time of your life, too. Because, I eat less now than I did when I was skinny.
Yeah, it's true. You know, one of the things that was so interesting for me was to research this book. I spent about 3 months reading about sort of the science of fat and weight loss, how valuable fat can be to you at different times of your life. Now I'm talking about, you know, on not extreme cases of thinness or obesity, but you know, the fact that there's a like a tide to your weights. You know, when you're a girl going through puberty, you gain weight, you become more fertile, and when you go, when you're pregnant, you know, you gain weight for obvious reasons. When you go through menopause, you gain weight because fat produces hormones that you're not producing in other ways, and fat protects your bones, which are weakening as you get older. So it's really interesting to me, you know, when we're up against the diet industry, which we spend billions and billions of dollars on as a nation, we are setting ourselves up for failure in that respect. That diets don't work. You can always lose weight, but keeping it off is very difficult, and depriving yourself is very difficult to sustain for, I think it's 95% of people who diet and lose weight gain it back. So I think the idea of enjoying food and, you know, indulging sometimes and being aware that you need to honor your physical self and take care of yourself is a much more important message than you need to look like some unrealistic ideal who's been photoshopped.
Hmm. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kristen Higgins, author of Good Luck With That.
That's an interesting title.
Thank you. When Marley and Georgia get back home from Emerson's funeral and they look at that list and decide to take it on, I don't think they really realize what a monumental task it is, that at the end of the book they will have arrived at a place where they are so much healthier in terms of their mental health, emotional health, their self-esteem. So the title came from this idea of, you know, what you're attempting to do to silence the negative voices that are all around you and create your own path to loving yourself and being good to yourself. You know, you think, wow, that's a huge job. Good luck with that, ladies. And then the very last page of the book, that has a different implication. It's a kinder, less snarky interpretation of you know, good luck, you know, in the kindest possible way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Kristen, I'm looking at your webpage, which is kristenhiggins.com, and it has the covers of all your books. And one thing I noticed is that except for the three at the top, of which this is one, which I guess are the most recent, the others all have pictures of thin, beautiful women, usually with a guy. Mm-hmm. And on this, right. Like this one, you don't have the women pictured.
I have been moving into women's fiction from romance. I started off writing romantic comedy, and I do think that all my books are romantic and funny in parts. And, you know, it's interesting. I've written women who are overweight. In my first book, Millie, the heroine, loses weight. She's one of those women who thinks I have to diet away my graduate school, medical school weight gain, and get to that place where I can finally go for the guy kind of thing. And she learns, too, that, you know, a guy who only notices her when she weighs whatever is not worth her time. He's not the hero of the book. In another book, my heroine is 6 feet tall, and her size is an issue. I've written quite a few curvy heroines. But what I wanted to do, and I've written some beautiful heroines too, and their beauty is never just a fact. It's always an issue. And I think that's true. Mm. Like, I don't know a single woman who has felt like how I look doesn't matter at all. If I'm beautiful, that carries some issues. One of my heroines is strikingly beautiful, but she looks just like the mother who abandoned her when she was 13 years old. So every time she looks in the mirror, she sees her mother, and it's a burden for her. Another woman is like the high school slut. She sleeps around, and she's always judged on her beauty, too, and assumptions are made about how she looks. But I've tried to always write what I call regular people, you know, neither stunningly beautiful nor, you know, the opposite of that. This is the first book where I really dug into how much size, especially, and looks affect us. And it was not not without controversy because, you know, we all, as you said earlier, we all know that it's what's inside that matters, and it's what you do and how you treat people that define you as a person. And yet, we're surrounded mm-hmm. with all these images of women who look a certain way, who are a certain size. We celebrate them. We worship them. I mean, Beyoncé is called the queen, right? And she's super talented, but also incredibly beautiful.
Although, and, you know, she's bigger than a lot of women. And, I mean,
yes.
She doesn't seem to have any body image problems. Let's put it that way.
Right. But she's, you know, she's a certain type of curvy, right?
Right.
You know, she's like the acceptable curvy. If
yeah.
I'm using air quotes for that.
Yeah.
Acceptable. You know, she's very fertile and luscious and also, you know, very fit, very toned. She can dance in those 4-inch heels like nobody's business. And she's one of, actually, she's one of like my body image heroines because she did an ad campaign a few years ago where they photoshopped her to make her look thinner, and she made them take every picture down.
Wow.
And she said, nope, that's not me. That's not how I look, so put me up like that.
Wow.
But
good
getting
for
back
her.
To your original question, my women's fiction books have started to leave the couples off the covers because, you know, it's, I think women's fiction is more a journey of the heroine, whereas a romance is more the journey of the couple.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But let's talk about beauty pageants a minute. you know, when, I mean, like you say, they start very young nowadays, mm. don't they?
Yes. You know, there was a show on a few years ago called Toddlers and Tiaras,
mm-hmm.
and you know, about putting your children into beauty pageants as young as the age of, like, one. And I thought it was, like, child abuse. I really did. You know, they would sugar up the kids. They would give them these, like, powdery sugar candies and Coke and to get them because the kids are tired and they want to go to sleep. And, you know, and then they'd, like, push them on stage and make them do their little routine. And it just seemed horrible. It was like child labor almost. And,
yeah.
You know, when you're doing this, when you're putting false eyelashes on your 2-year-old, you really have to kind of step back and think about,
oh my gosh,
the messages that you're sending, you know. It's, you know, it just starts so young, you know.
Well, it's akin to the dad that his son has to play football.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same deal,
right,
because
right.
He wasn't so good at it, but my son's going to be good at it, you know.
Yes.
So,
yes. And I think that, you know, that's a very good point that, you know, what beauty is to women, athleticism can be to men. And
mm-hmm. And
you
show that in the book too, with the relationship with Mason and his father, who, you know, I was really hoping that the dad would get a little better, and he does get a little better, but
yeah. I think there's a glimmer of hope for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has had a tremendous loss. He's a widower, and he really loved his wife. And now he's raising his son alone. And what he focuses on is, you know, he needs to protect Mason as much as possible. And that means make him popular, make him strong, make him a great athlete, because those are the things that served him as a child. And he doesn't want to accept Mason as sort of the nerdy, sweet boy that he is.
But in protecting him, he's abusing him.
Right, right. But his intention is, I have to make him strong.
Right.
And I have to give him every advantage. And he doesn't see the damage that he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, Kristen, would you like to read a little bit from Good Luck With That?
Oh, sure. Give me a second to grab my copy of a book, which I have somewhere around here. One of the things that I tried to do with the book was make it funny in parts, and because I love to write comedy and I love to write social commentary, and one of the parts of the book that I really enjoyed writing was when the women go to this elite store to one of the things on the list is shop at a store for regular people, by which she meant like not a plus size store. So Georgia and Marley are there going to a yoga shop called Pomegranate and Plum. So this is told from Georgia's point of view. Our steps slowed as we approached the store warily. Pomegranate and Plum. Oh, God. Every insecurity I'd ever had stared back at me. Not here, I said. Let's go to Marshall's. Calm yourself, Marley muttered, grabbing my arm as I tried to bolt. You're getting workout gear. I have workout gear, I whispered. I've seen those yoga pants, she whispered back. It's time to burn them. Besides, we'll be running. Those yoga pants would fall off you. Think of Emerson and how proud she'd be shopping in this horrible place. Pomegranate and Plum was the new must-have brand in Cambria on Hudson. I knew this because I saw their logo on roughly 80% of the mothers who dropped their kids off at preschool each day, the two P's mirroring each other. Pomegranate and Plum, smile, sweat, slay. In other words, wear those clothes to your hot yoga classes as a status symbol to showcase your perfect, almost often surgically altered body, and rub it into everyone bigger than a size 6. Or don't go to hot yoga or vinyasa yoga or whatever yoga was hip this year. Just wear the clothes, because really that's what it was all about. P&P didn't carry sizes bigger than a medium, because God forbid the fatties wanted to work out too, you know, to lose weight or anything. They could do it in clothes from a less holy place than Pomegranate and Plum, which was a shrine to female physical perfection and Photoshop, I hoped. Marley, for all her bravado, appeared to be frozen as well. We stood at the front of the store, clutching each other's arms as we stared. Oh, the obnoxious signs. J'aime yoga, the French making the statement that much less believable. Money doesn't matter without love, which was ironic because a person couldn't shop at P&P without a good deal of money. Worst, though, were the pictures of women clad in Pomegranate and Plum clothing, which didn't look a lot from the stuff I saw at Target and Marshall's, just saying. Giant silkscreen photos hung throughout the store, showing impossibly slender yet muscular women, all white, I noted, doing things that weren't usually seen outside of a gulag. One showed a beautiful, poreless brunette with skin that looked like it had been oiled, her perfect, gleaming teeth gritted. She was dressed in P&P's muted colors, a harness on her shoulders so she could pull a pickup truck, as one does. The caption at the bottom read, opera singer Elise Kierkegaard keeps her vocal cords and her body in top shape while wearing Pomegranate and Plum's Excelsior low-rise workout trousers. Trousers, I whispered, because pants are so bourgeois. Marley snorted. Another picture showed a blonde woman with a long satiny ponytail and hypnotically sculpted thighs leaping across a mountain peak. When she's not advising the Secretary General of the United Nations, Maren Hastings loves free climbing in the Andes, wearing Pomegranate and Plum's penultimate fleece hoodie. I went to Princeton with her, whispered Marley. Just think what your sign can say, Marley whispered back. Whispering felt appropriate in this church of the 1%. When she's not wiping little bottoms in her preschool for extremely advanced children, Georgia Sloan enjoys lying on the couch in her Pomegranate and Plum super-duper jod furs, watching Naked and Afraid. Why are we here again, Marley? I'm scared. She squeezed my arm. It's like hazing for skinny people. You might puke now, but you'll look back on this day fondly. The day I paid for workout clothes at a ridiculous store. Happy times, she said. Let's not forget the immortal words, shop at a store for regular people. It's on the list. I can't do it, so you have to. She was right. The idea of being able to go into a, quote, normal, quote, store, where those sizes stopped at 12 or 14, had been an elusive dream back then. I could still remember the three of us talking about how we'd go into the dressing rooms, not getting the side eye from clerks or other shoppers, trying on pants that were too big and having to go down a size, to single digits even. Now here I was, possibly about to fit into a medium, and it was weirdly terrifying. Marley took a shirt off the rack and held it up to her ample chest. The shirt looked as if it would fit one of my students. Think I can get even one boob into this thing, she said. Can I help you find something, a voice said, and we both jumped. A beautiful woman, no more than 25, smiled at me. Her skin was dewy, her hair shiny, her eyebrows magically perfect. She was tall and slim, thigh gap visible, calves perfectly sculpted. You should be a model, I blurted. Oh, aren't you sweet, she said in a flat voice that said she heard it every day. And please, if she could have been a model, did I really think she'd be working here? What can I help you with today? She stared at me, almost daring me to slink out. Her gaze never once flickered to Marley. My friends and I are doing an Ironman, I said, though me doing an Ironman and giving birth to Bruno Mars's child had about the same odds. I need some clothes. Wonderful, she said, still not blinking. Right this way. My name is Aspen. How about that, I said. I have sisters named Paris and Milan, and my name is Georgia. We love geography in my family. Aspen did not respond. Perhaps she was unaware that Aspen, Paris, Milan, and Georgia were all places. Perhaps she felt she should be the sole bearer of her name, Colorado and trees be damned. So that's, I think that's a good example of sort of the terror of the elitism of size, shopping, how hard it is, even though Georgia has lost weight, and she hasn't lost weight for good reasons. I think that's a point that I want to make. She's ignoring a health issue, and yet the seduction of the fact that this health issue is making her lose weight has prevented her from going to the doctor to get treatment. And I know that's happened to people, you know, it's happened to me, it's happened to people I know, where you think, like, do I really want this fixed? Because look at me, I've lost 10 pounds, you know. So even though Georgia is, you know, now down to a certain size, she's very intimidated at the idea of joining this group that has always shunned her before, you know, this group of sizists, you know. And I know personally, I've been into so many stores where the biggest size hasn't come close to fitting me. You know, and it's really demoralizing to try on an extra large at J. Crew and not be able to button it.
I'll tell you, I went shopping in Hong Kong. I don't think there was a store in the whole dang city that I could fit into anything.
Right. But in that case, you know, you can kind of justify it and make sense thinking, like, well, perhaps this demographic is much smaller.
Right. And, you know, I was going into fairly high-end stores that tend to, everything runs small anyway, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it was like, oh, wow, this is no
Forget
fun
it.
At all.
Yeah. Right, and, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, Abercrombie & Fitch said they would not carry bigger sizes because there were people saying, like, can you make this in a 16 or a 24? And the CEO said, no, we don't want you people dressing in our clothes. We have a certain brand, and you don't fit it because you're fat. And it was just that ugly and bald, and he got creamed on social media and by the news and everything, but there it was. You know, he was telling the truth.
Yeah.
You can special order a Giorgio Armani dress, I suppose, in a size 16, but you're not going to find it in the showroom.
You know, one of the stores that I shop at quite a lot, one of the reasons I like it is because their mediums fit me.
Mm-hmm.
And in most other stores, their mediums would be a large.
Right. And there's that, too, that, you know, the manipulation of, oh, look at me, I'm a size 6.
Yeah.
You know? You know, you're probably not in those stores, you know, but they're making you feel good about yourself, so you'll come back.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love Project Runway. That's one of my favorite shows, and I love Tim Gunn. Most of all, I want him for my best friend. And he is a real advocate for people of all sizes. And on the last season of Project Runway, he had models who ranged in size from a 2 to a 24. And it was so wonderful to force these contestants on the show, the designers, to dress women of all sizes.
That is good.
Right, you know, and you'd think, like, you can't believe they don't do it already, especially in America where the average size is like a 16.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Kristen Higgins, New York Times best-selling author of Good Luck With That. Now, has this book been released?
Yes, and I'm just winding down a wonderful book tour I've been to 20 of my 27 cities or 23 of my 27 cities so far.
Whoa.
So, yeah, it's been a lot. And, you know, the reaction of readers and reviewers has been really, really beautiful. You know, people saying, I didn't know other people felt like this, or it was like you were in my head, Kristen.
Mm-hmm.
And also saying, you know, I needed to read this because I've spent so much time not liking myself. I realized what I could have done with all that time if I could have just turned off that pressure. And now I'm done. I'm going to focus on taking care of myself and liking myself and making friends with my body right now, not 50 pounds or 100 pounds from now, right now. And that's just so amazing to me as an author. It's so humbling and so exciting at the same time, you know, where you think, this was my message, but I wrote this book for my little 4-year-old self and for my 53-year-old self, and also, you know, with the hopes that it would strike the right chord in readers. But I've just been bowled over by the love and excitement for this book, and so many people have said the word, like, it's cleansing. It's, you know, one woman wrote to me, she said, I threw out all my Spanx today. You know, I am who I am, and no more squishing myself into uncomfortable underwear.
Well, you know, for the most part, when I've tried that stuff, it just squishes it to some other part, you know?
Exactly.
It might flatten the stomach, but it comes out somewhere else.
I know, and it's, you know, it's uncomfortable. And, you know, why should we pretend to look different? You know, who are we trying to fool? And I think, you know, it's not just weight, but whatever insecurity you have. You know, do you have crooked teeth, or do you think your nose is too big, or whatever it is? You know, just letting go of this ideal that 99.95 of us will never get to, and just learning to appreciate ourselves physically and emotionally, you know, psychically, in all the ways that matter, and not waiting to start your best life or going after the things that you want, because right now, exactly right now, you deserve them. Go for it.
Now, Kristen, the book deals a lot with kind of issues of weight and romance, and, you know, an overweight, you know, Marley being attracted to a man who really likes her but won't even consider her as a girlfriend because of her weight, and also, you know, Georgia having been in love with or married to a man who didn't care about her weight, but she couldn't believe that. And kind of,
yeah, that was so sad.
Sabotaged things because she couldn't trust that he didn't care if she gained weight. But you also deal with women and how maybe sometimes women can be even more cruel about weight. Even women who are overweight kind of like judge each other on, well, I'm not as fat as she is.
Exactly.
Kind of thing.
Exactly.
Do you think women are worse than men, or is it pretty much the same?
I do. I think women are much harder on each other and themselves than men are. You know, there's that old saying, if you want to please your man, show up naked. You know? And you know, the idea that they are much less critical or judgy. And Raphael, in Good Luck With That, is this wonderful man, wonderful husband, and he adores Georgia because she's intelligent and funny and observant, and he thinks she's beautiful and desirable. But she's grown up with these messages from her mother and her brother and even her dad, who marries two very beautiful women, that looks and size matter. And she just doesn't believe that if he knew all of her insecurities that he would love her. And so she creates this distance between them. And an acquaintance of mine said to me, she said, that is exactly what happened with me. Like, it was just hard to believe and hard to feel like the person that he saw was really me. And it's heartbreaking, you know, because Raphael is the love of George's life, and she just can't trust him and be relaxed around him. And it sabotages their marriage. And then also the character of Will Harding in the book, who's one of George's clients, George's personal chef. She brings meals to people. And they have a really interesting dynamic because Will is very unfiltered. He's on the spectrum. And he tells her at one point, like, you know, he acknowledges that she's fat. And she goes crazy. She's like, you can't say that to a woman. You know, you can't tell a woman that she's fat. And he said, but you are. You know, he doesn't understand the problem. It's just a fact for him. And she's saying, you know, fat is a four-letter word, and you know, this is, what a horrible thing to say. I quit as your chef. You know, but what she comes to learn is that he's not judging her for that. That's what she's bringing to the table, you know, mm-hmm. that fat is a four-letter word. He's just making an observation in a, you know, an ungraceful way, of course, but he finds her quite attractive, and he's very confused in that scene. Like, I said you looked nice, you know, even though you're fat. And she's like, of course I know I'm fat. He's like, so what's the problem here, you know? And yet there she's spending all her time with this man who won't acknowledge her in public as his girlfriend, you know. So she's got some thinking to do about that, too, and also the judgments that she makes about people based on their looks. And Will calls her on that a little bit, and it's kind of an interesting conversation for her.
And then Marley's sister, older sister, Eva, is also fat, and mm-hmm. but
yeah,
she doesn't seem to have an issue with it at all.
No, she's one of those people who's really happy the way she is, and I love her, and I admired her. I definitely wanted to present a character who was obese and completely fine with it. You know, Marley worries about her health, but and in the end, you know, offers to start cooking for her, but not so Eva can lose weight, just so she can be healthier and eat better. And, you know, if you have a sister who's a chef, by all means, let her cook for you. but, yeah, Eva has no problem with being overweight and also single. You know, she's just a very content person, and I really wanted to present that point of view as well. You know, that there are plenty of people, as I said in the beginning of the show, you know, who are fine with where they are exactly right now and have no problem with it. And I think we should all aspire to care much less about how we look.
Well, I will say that I was raised in an environment where very little focus was put on appearance, on looks. You know,
really lucky.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Mom, I don't remember you ever saying a word about how I looked. Really?
No, probably not.
and Dad either.
I'm sure she thought you were just adorable.
Yeah,
you know?
And Dad certainly. My father's only, he's been gone for many, many years, but his only concern was that I didn't get focused on my looks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, that's very healthy, and I've tried to do the same with my kids, you know, that it's who you are and what you do and how you affect others that's going to define mm-hmm. you in life. It's not your eye color or pant size, you know.
Yeah, but you know, even without getting that from my parents, I didn't avoid it completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it's possible to avoid completely, but you have that foundation.
Not.
You know, Marley had that foundation as well, and good luck with that. She was raised in a very loving family where everyone was overweight, except for her little brother, whose, you know, job requires him to be very fit. He's FDNY. And her size is celebrated because she's sturdy and strong and a, you know, big, healthy girl. And it's especially poignant because her twin dies when they're four, and her twin is very frail and small and is always kind of sickly. And so, of course, Marley, being healthy and strong and loud and fun, you know, is going to be celebrated. And even her being overweight, at least she's not, you know, wasting away. Mm. And I think that Marley has a much better self-image because of it. You know, she grew up loved, and every child should grow up loved, you know, and certainly not judged on something as shallow as how much you weigh.
Kristen, how did you get started writing novels?
Oh, well, I was a stay-at-home mom in my 30s, and I had never thought about writing a book until my kids were born, and I had a lot of time alone. My husband is a firefighter, and most firefighters work two jobs. He was no exception. And so I was alone a lot, and I loved my kids, loved doing stuff with them, but I kind of missed adult company, you know. And aside from the story hour at the library, I didn't get out too much. And so I started thinking about what I would do when my son, who's younger, went to school full-time, and I would be home, but without the kids to take care of for a good 8 hours a day. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to, you know, find some way to help the family financially. And I thought, well, I wonder if I could write a book, because I had read voraciously since I was 4 years old. I remember reading Yertle the Turtle by myself, good old Dr. Seuss. He's still my favorite author. So I had read, and I loved romance novels in high school and college. They were always kind of my reward for getting through heavier literature. And I thought, I bet I could write a romantic comedy. And I gave myself a deadline of, you know, by the time my son started first grade, sold a book. And so I wrote a book that I thought would be relatable and fun. And I thought, like, who doesn't like romantic comedy? And I set it in a small town because I live in a small town. And I sold that book and never expected to have a career as a novelist. But here I am all these years later. I think it's been 16 years that I started. And good luck with that is my 18th book.
Oh, my God.
So more than a book a year.
Yeah, and for a few years it was more than a book a year, and now it's about a book a year.
So are the books you're writing now more meatier, in a sense?
I think so. You know, I love a good romantic comedy, but for me, I was really drawn to a person's whole life rather than just the relationship woes. I wanted to delve into, you know, how your childhood affects you, how certain incidents can affect you, you know, issues with family and work and past relationships and how they all bring you to where you are in that moment. So, yeah, I guess I could say they are meatier now. And have bigger challenges for the people to overcome until they get that happy ending.
How do you come up with kind of unique ideas? There's so many romances out there, so many, kind of women's fiction. How do you come up with a unique situation? I mean, I feel like you really did here in Good Luck With That. But is that difficult for you to do?
It is, because, you know, there's a lot of great ideas out there. You know, will it last 400 pages?
Yeah.
You know, is it enough of an issue or conundrum that it's going to be difficult to solve? And so a lot of times my stories come from situations that just interest me, you know, in this case. You know, aside from I want to write about women who struggle with body image and self-esteem, I also wanted to write about what's it like to lose a twin. That must be such a devastating loss. And so I researched that and talked to some some twins who had lost their twin, and also, you know, like, what's it like to be addicted? This was my first heroine that I'd written who had an addiction in terms of Emerson. I shouldn't say heroine because she doesn't, you know, her story is a tragedy. She does not get a happy ending. But I love to listen to people talk and tell me their stories, and I think I have a very, like, open face because people tend, even strangers tend to tell me what's going on with them, and I just think everyone has a story that's worth hearing. So there's no end to what's out there. And in terms of choosing the one that I write about, it's usually the situation that keeps me up at night.
When you start with the situation and you build the characters around it, but do you know where the story's going when you start? Do you always have the end in mind?
I like to have the story at least roughly mapped out, and because I'm an organized person, I guess, you know, I like to know where I'm driving, I like to know where I'm writing, you know, and so I have scenes that I know will happen or scenes that can structure the book, and then about 200 pages in, the outline falls by the wayside and the story takes a life of its own.
Well, Kristen, I'd love to hear more about that, but we are out of time.
All right. Well, it was so lovely talking to you, ladies.
It was great fun. And, Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Well, I just want everybody to read this book. And the best thing that you can gain by reading this is finding peace in your heart about who you are.
Beautifully said. Couldn't agree more.
Well, thank you, and see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.